Hello, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today we're pleased to have Dr. William Norquist, who is the author of The Stealth Killer, Is Oral Spirochetosis the Missing Link in Dental and Heart Disease Labyrinth? Hello, Dr. Norquist, how are you today?
Very good, how are you?
Great. I don't know whether you know it, but I'm a plastic surgeon, and as a plastic surgeon, I've been studying biofilms for some time, because guess what forms around breast implants?
Yes, I know of biofilms.
Right. I think that when we discover more about how biofilms work, we'll be able to understand a lot about the chronic disease states that we seem to be finding ourselves in, a large majority of the population are in anyway. I think they hold the key. And, of course, spirochetes are one aspect of these biofilms, and spirochetes are very interesting in that they have the ability to go inside cells and hide.
Right.
And that is what makes them so interesting. Would you like to tell the listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to study this?
It's very interesting. I suppose my interest in bacteriology went back to dental school, and I had a instructor that was just incredible in bacteriology. And
hello, this is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today we are speaking with Dr. William Norquist, the author of The Stealth Killer, Is Oral Spirochetosis a Missing Link in Dental and Heart Disease Labyrinth. We were talking a little bit about biofilms before the adjustment occurred, and Dr. Norquist was about to tell us how he learned about spirochetes in dental disease.
Well, it's a long story. Back in 2000, the Surgeon General came up with a report. It was actually the first report on dentistry ever by a Surgeon General, and he related periodontal disease to heart disease and other chronic inflammatory diseases. And at that time, I decided to go ahead and start studying that, so I purchased a microscope and started studying plaque around patients' teeth to discover what I could see and find relationships. And over a long period of time, I started seeing that spirochetes were very prevalent, especially when we had bone loss. And the more severe the disease, the more I saw spirochetes. And that kind of led me down the road of originally thinking with spirochetes. But in 2006, in that area, I watched a documentary about heart disease. It's called The Hidden Epidemic, Heart Disease in America, and it's a PBS special. And on that program, they related that heart disease became prevalent after World War II. And so I started doing research, and I'm thinking, if periodontal disease is related to heart disease, what changed in periodontal disease 20, 30 years ahead of after World War II, when people started dying of heart attacks in large numbers? And it turned out to be trench mouth from World War I. And it fell exactly in that time frame, and that's a spirochetal disease. So that,
right,
emphasized spirochetes. And the trail went on and on and on as I spent several months researching out different spirochetal diseases, which included syphilis and then Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a spirochetal disease, and millions of dollars has gone into studying Lyme disease. And that is related to chronic inflammatory diseases. And also syphilis, the tertiary stage of syphilis, is related to chronic inflammatory diseases. So I started to think that, well, oral spirochetes could also be related to chronic inflammatory diseases. So that's kind of in a nutshell how it came on to the spirochetes.
That would also explain why the industrialized nations have more of a problem with heart disease, in that they are more likely to be meat eaters, and meat, especially, I guess, meat that's not cooked real well, might be the source of the spirochetes. Is that something that you think might be true?
Well, it is true. In fact, there's some sparse research in Lyme disease that you can catch Lyme disease by eating contaminated beef from cattle that have Lyme disease. And also, cattle have a disease called digital dermatitis, which is a lesion right between the hoofs, and it's a spirochetal disease as well. And when you do DNA tests, believe it or not, digital dermatitis spirochete is 98% the same as Treponema vincini, which is the same spirochete that causes trench mouth. And also there's another spirochete in cattle that's 95% the same as the most common spirochete in dental diseases, Treponema denticala. So there is a life cycle. We think that one part of the life cycle of a spirochete is once it gets into your body, and we feel they get in through the diseased gingival sulcus. They get into the bloodstream, and they have the ability to get through the endothelial lining of blood vessels, at which time the body attacks it. And then it just rolls up into a spore, either what we call a cell wall deficient body or a cystic body, and then that becomes dormant. And that's how syphilis stays dormant for so many years. And then eventually it causes chronic inflammatory diseases and possibly the death of the animal, but the spore remains in the meat because blood vessels are throughout the body, including the meat, and so that becomes carrion, eaten by the next animal, and then that gets stuck in their teeth and rots, and then the spirochetes get in through. And so there's the life cycle, or at least one life cycle of a spirochete. So beef in particular seems to be, again, this has not been proven, but I think that research is needed to prove this fact that the spirochete life cycle includes beef. It's one of the ways that we can catch these spirochetal diseases. Oral to oral is the most common way of catching them, though.
And it's interesting that there's the link between that you made between Alzheimer's disease and it improving on long-term antibiotic treatment that targeted these spirochetes, and having the possibility that could be connected with the information that we have on prions also coming from the meat source. So now we have two possible vectors coming through meat that might cause these chronic mental disorders.
I know.
And the question is, you know, of course we don't know. Are they related? Are they likely to be in the same animals? Are they, you know, or are they entirely separate?
They're probably separate.
Yeah, but a lot of the, I'm sorry?
Long before I came up with this idea of spirochetes, I was lecturing about what I call multiple missing tooth syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an implant dentist. I do, my main practice is dentistry, but I'm board certified by the American Board of Oral Implantology, and I'm an implantologist full time. And I work on people with a lot of missing teeth, and the people that I've noticed with a lot of missing teeth have all these chronic inflammatory diseases. And when I'm doing surgery on these patients with a lot of missing teeth, they have a lot of diseases that I have to watch out for. Heart disease, diabetes are the main two, but then the whole spectrum of chronic inflammatory diseases. I almost have to be a physician to be an implantologist because I'm dealing with people that aren't all sick. All of them are sick in one way or another. So in these multiple missing tooth, as it turned out in recent studies, it's the bone loss part of periodontal disease that's related to these chronic inflammatory diseases. And when we see bone loss, you know, and microscopically, and then those of us who have studied periodontal disease microscopically know that when you have bone loss, the predominant organism are spirochetes.
Right.
So this is, I mean, the evidence is just mounting. There's one study that is coming out in the Journal of Implantology here this month that relates genomes. And when they did a study of all the genomes in the body, and then they created periodontal disease or gingivitis in these patients, and then they studied the genomes again. Well, gingivitis activates 30% of the genomes in the human body, and that study is coming out this month in the Journal of Periodontology, which indicates gingivitis, and I'm beginning to think the portal of entry for these chronic inflammatory diseases is the diseased gingival sulcus. Why else would all 30% of the genomes be activated when you get gingivitis if that weren't such an important portal of entry into the body?
And there's another thing to consider. I treat about 2,000 women with silicone disease, which is a combination chemical and biotoxicity of the biofilms around the breast implants once they start to leak or rupture or otherwise get infected just from bacteremias. In any case, the majority of these women have periodontal disease, and many of them start missing teeth. And what I think is going on, the mold that is that occurs in and around the implants, which I'm sure occur in and around all implants, produces a biotoxin that depresses the natural killer T cells. In addition, once the implants become leaky, which they do pretty much in 8 to 10 years through a lipolysis reaction, the chemicals that leak out are solvents. And the solvent toxicity is pretty much, periodontal disease is pretty much ubiquitous in that patient population. And so although frequent, as you mentioned in your book, frequent cleanings and stepped up oral hygiene can help maybe make it so you don't lose your teeth, it doesn't do much about solving the disease. And in fact, until you actually remove the implants and put them on long-term antibiotics and antifungals, do you see the periodontal disease start to go away?
Right.
So depressed immune system can start it as well. You know, that's the other reason we get periodontal disease is our immune system's depressed.
Right. Well, periodontal disease is in just normal people without periodontal disease still have these bugs in their gingival sulcus, and I think dentists need to be taking plaque samples from people that don't show signs or symptoms, because I think the gingival sulcus is an incubator for these, and it takes, when the biofilm gets to a certain percent of different bacteria, then it causes first gingivitis, and that's like your first chancre. So it only takes one chancre to get syphilis. And it only takes one tick bite to get Lyme disease. Yet, in periodontal disease, patients run around with bleeding gums for part of their whole life. And there's no wonder that the immune system isn't overwhelmed. And the way the immune system works in the gingival sulcus is the bacteria comes in, and once that first gingivitis occurs, it causes chemotaxis, and all the immune cells come into the gingival sulcus, and then they sit there and the bacteria produces inhibitors, and the immune system becomes totally impotent in the gingival sulcus. It just sits there. And you can see the immune system and the bacteria, and nothing is going on to get rid of the bacteria, because the bacteria has been sophisticated enough to produce the different inhibitors to keep the immune system from actually engulfing it and killing it. And I think that's what happens once bacteremias occur and these bacteria get into the body, they inhibit the immune system, and I think that's where the autoimmune diseases come from, and that's a whole other story if we want to get into it.
Well, I think it is good to get into the your theories on autoimmune disease, because I thoroughly agree with them. There are two major classes of intracellular bacteria. One are the spirochetes, which can cause Lyme's and, you know, a number of other chronic diseases. And then there's the mycoplasmas. And the mycoplasmas are associated with fibromyalgia, as you might know. And also Dr. Garth Nicholson associated with them with at least 50% cases of rheumatoid arthritis. So you have a very, very strong link between intracellular bacteria and autoimmune disease. And your explanation in your book is a very good one. Would you like to go into that a little bit? Because that is fascinating, and autoimmune disease is becoming more and more common, especially in the industrialized countries.
Well, it's interesting that as the book that I wrote progressed, I mean, this all came to me almost, it cascaded in front of my eyes when I got a couple clues. And, you know, when you have a theory and the theory is correct, then everything will back that theory up. And even if you find one thing that doesn't back it up, it throws the theory out. So far, nothing has come along that has refuted this theory. But the way spirochetes work, they have the ability to change form. And this is what has not been understood in the medical profession, and especially the clinical physicians and dentists have not understood that spirochetes can actually, in an adverse environment, they roll up into, I guess you would call it a cell wall deficient form or a spore form.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
then it can go into a further cystic form, which is even more protected. And once I became aware of that, the research on some of this started at turn of the century on syphilis. And I think that mainly that research was done in France. And I'm not even sure how much of that research was disseminated throughout the world or from the U.S. I don't know if other scientists other than the French scientists understood at least the granular forms of spirochetes, which are formed at the near the death of a spirochete, that forms maybe 12 to 14 granular bodies inside the cell wall, and then the cell wall breaks down, and then those go into the intracellular fluid or wherever the spirochete is, and then each one of those can develop into a spirochete. So that's something that we didn't understand in dentistry for sure. And for sure, we didn't understand the life cycles of spirochetes and their ability to change form in adverse conditions. But we did know that we could not cure periodontal disease. It always comes back. If you do periodontal surgery and you don't get rid of the periodontal pathogens and the patient stops brushing their teeth, it always comes back. And with the frustrating thing we've had in dentistry. But getting into how the autoimmune disease works, I mean, the way I perceive it, is once you get a bacterium out of a spirochete, it gets into the endothelial lining of a blood vessel, and then it's attacked and even phagocytized by lymphocytes. And then at that point, it's either turned into an inclusive body or a phagocytome, or it just converts at that point into a cell wall deficient body, and then it transforms the immune cell into what I call a host cell, you know, for the spirochete. But the signals of pathogenicity are still going out from the DNA of the spirochete in some way, and it turns that cell now into a cell that will be attacked by itself, other immune cells will begin to attack that cell. Well, that's the definition of an autoimmune disease right there. But it's not because the immune system is attacking its own self. It's attacking an altered form of itself. And and I think you could apply that to every one of the autoimmune diseases as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it might interest you to know that there's scientific evidence that both MS and Lou Gehrig's disease are associated with an intracellular spirochete and that information was actively suppressed.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Dr. Garth Nicholson. Well, talk to Dr. Garth Nicholson.
Uh-huh.
He wrote a paper on the neurodegenerative diseases and intracellular spirochetes. He was on my radio show. And then talk to Dr. Lydia Matman. She is the author of Cell Wall Deficient Form. She can tell you a great deal about the suppression of her research.
Right.
There's reasons for that, too. You know, there's reasons for that because spent 13 years in the U.S. Air Force as a officer, and I know quite a bit about biological warfare. Those two are linked, let me tell you.
Interesting.
Very interesting. You might want to contact those two individuals because what they have to tell you is not necessarily published.
Okay.
Yeah. So in any case, we have a lot of information indicating that certain autoimmune diseases, and especially those associated with the neurological system, may very well have intracellular spirochetes as at least a common denominator. So I'd like to back up at this point and mention that the link to heart disease is intimately connected with a lab value that we find high as physicians, and that would be C-reactive protein. And I wanted to ask you if it is the regular C-reactive protein or the C-reactive protein cardiac that you're referring to in your book, because I've had patients with fairly normal C-reactive proteins, but their C-reactive protein cardiacs are very high.
Well, I don't know why necessarily we think of heart disease as the coronary arteries, but when I look at heart disease, I don't think it's just isolated to the coronary arteries. I think the atherosclerotic lesions are distributed throughout the body. And the coronary arteries are more vulnerable to breakdown and heart attacks because they're under...
They're smaller.
Right, and then the heart is beating and they're under more pressure and a lot more activity is going on there than in other parts of the body so that, you know, these lesions can break down and cause a clot or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the life cycle of a spirochete, I don't think they care where they are. I think they can be in any endothelial part of the body as long as it becomes eaten by the next animal that eats it upon the death of that host, and that completes the life cycle of the spirochete to get into the next host. So that's the heart disease thing is just it's just a bad place for you to have a big lesion because you need all the integrity of the blood vessel you can when you have a beating heart. And when that breaks down, boom, you're dead. So that's my theory on that.
Yeah, well, it's true, and also the strokes that come off the bifurcation of the coronary arteries, the same thing. You know, it's just a very small little piece of stuff that breaks off, but when it ends in a end artery with the brain beyond it, you get a stroke. So,
yeah.
It's really whatever is it's really the location of the disease that causes so much trouble.
Are you familiar with Trevor Marshall's work in Australia? Any chance?
No, I'm not.
Chronic inflammatory diseases, but he did biogenome studies.
Mm-hmm.
And he studied the number of bacteria and organism in saliva, normal saliva, and he found there's over 100. And the fact that there's a lot of pathogens into that, too. So just plain saliva from normal people without disease has a lot of bacteria in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he took all the chronic inflammatory diseases and he just made a circle with it all the way around, just made a circle and then put about at least 100 chronic inflammatory diseases. And then he went to PubMed and he did what was called comorbidities. In other words, if you had arthritis, what other chronic inflammatory diseases did you have? And then he
mm-hmm.
connected it through the circle with a line. And then by the time he went all the way around and took each chronic inflammatory disease and then studied what comorbidities or what other chronic inflammatory diseases that patient had, the total circles was obliterated by lines going through it. When his conclusion was that all these chronic inflammatory diseases are interrelated to each other. So based on that, I took the same circle with the same chronic inflammatory diseases, and I went through my charts of people with multiple missing teeth that required dental implants. And
mm-hmm.
a missing tooth is a proxy for bone loss because otherwise you wouldn't lose the tooth. If you lose a tooth because of periodontal disease, that's because of bone loss. Bone loss seems to be what is related to these chronic inflammatory diseases. So I put periodontal disease at the top of the chart and then listed all the chronic inflammatory diseases around the rest of the circle, and by the time I got done, I had periodontal disease seemed to be the common denominator between all the chronic inflammatory diseases. So
that makes sense.
It does, and it's and when you think of the bacteria that's in the mouth, how does it get into the body? It can't get in the body unless there's a break in the epithelium somewhere or the. Well, most people, 80% of people have. At least some form of periodontal disease, which means an open wound that's right around your teeth. Well, that's the portal of entry for these diseases into the body. And it's so simple to prevent. You know, if the dentist would just take, like before you clean your teeth, I would never get a bloody prophy again in your life.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the hygienist and they clean your teeth, say, okay, please take some betadine and a little syringe and run it around my gums. And then wait 5 minutes before you clean
your teeth. Before you clean your teeth.
Right, so you don't cause a bacteremia.
Well, that's important.
It is extremely important.
It is. I've seen people almost die of, mitral valve infections.
Right.
You know, from teeth cleanings.
You know, I don't want to put down dentists because we've come a long ways in preventing dental disease, especially
mm-hmm.
with fluoride, and people 30, 35, and 40 and under don't have cavities or periodontal disease because actually fluoride in the crystalline called fluorapatite does actually prevent decay, but also fluoride inhibits the treponemas or the spirochetes. So if a spirochete needs to have a low pH. So in the gingival sulcus, as it drops the pH down, it leaches out fluoride from the fluorapatite that's caused by fluoridation. And the fluoride actually inhibits that drop in pH. So we've noticed that young people don't seem to have periodontal disease and caries anywhere near what we used to have, you know, before
fluoride, right.
Fluoride's a little bit of fluoride's good, a lot of fluoride's bad. So I'm just talking
about a little bit. And it depends on how you put it in, too. Your book describes two methods that actually the dentist does that are much more of a directed treatment toward the area of problem rather than putting it in the water supply.
Right. And I think that, you know, sometimes you think, well, a little bit of something is good and a lot's got to be better. That's not the case with fluoride. It's a trace mineral. We do need it, and it's not, it's poison in large amounts, but it's not in the small amounts because the appetite does take it up. And it's the natural antibiotic, so that spirochetes haven't worked its way around yet. So it definitely helps. And so dentists have, you know, gone a long way in preventing this in the younger population, but in the older populations, the baby boomers, which are coming along, those are the ones that are sinking our healthcare system right now, and it's because of the chronic inflammatory diseases. But all of those could be prevented just by very simple methods. Actually, can be done at home if you wanted to. You can go buy a water pick, and I don't know why dentists don't recommend them, other than the fact that that's the one thing that prevents dental disease more than anything else.
It might be an
economic reason that they don't recommend them.
Right.
But at any rate, you just take a water pick. And ideally, you should have your teeth cleaned, you know, or deep cleaning, get all the calculus and everything off your teeth. And then from that point on, using a water pick, and you can actually at the drugstore buy this surgical soap called HipaCleanse. It's H-I-B-I-C-L-E-N, HipaCleanse. It has 4% chlorhexidine in it and also soap. And I'll just make one comment about soap. I mean, the biggest discovery in the 18th century was the discovering that if you wash your hands with, if the physicians wash their hands with soap between patients, that they eliminate a lot of disease. Well, maybe the biggest discovery of the 21st century would be, you know, wash your mouth out with soap because it kills the bacteria. But at any rate, HipaCleanse has soap in it, and you take the HipaCleanse and squirt a little bit into like a water pick. And it creates what we call a bottle of Paradex, which Paradex has 0.12% chlorhexidine. And you just irrigate your gums with that every day, just before you go to bed. And then you take just plain baking soda and wet your toothbrush and just work the baking soda in around your teeth and your gums. And that baking soda neutralizes any of the acids that these treponema or the spirochetes form in it. And it basically just it nukes the not only spirochetes but everything else. It's a salt, you know. You can actually add salt to the baking soda as well, but baking soda is the main thing. So those two things, you know, irrigating your gums with HipaCleanse, so just it's a little bit into the bath of the irrigator, and follow it with baking soda. Or if you don't like the baking soda, you can get Arm & Hammer baking soda and peroxide. I have no conflict of interest in anything that I mention, okay? No financial interest in any of it. But those two things will prevent bacteremia. So it'll keep your gums super healthy. And
I'd also like to add that for those of my more holistic bent patients might substitute for HipaCleanse tea tree oil. Tea tree oil can be added to the water pick. It can be added to toothpaste. It can be added to it is added to mouthwash, and tea tree oil will destroy not only bacteria but viruses and also fungi. So,
oregano is good as well.
Right. So there are some natural things if you prefer not to do the HipaCleanse, you know, just because it's a chemical. You know, you just if you have an aversion to that, you can still do this treatment, and the baking soda and peroxide mixture is very good for the reasons that Dr. Norquist just said. And I also want to mention one other thing that that is very good. And that, have you ever heard of an anal heater?
No.
An anal heater, it was developed by Dr. McGee, Charles McGee, who was one of the original holistic doctors. And he discovered that an anal heater was a very, very good treatment for hemorrhoids. It's also a great treatment for prostate cancer. And in China, found that anal cancers would just disappear with the use of an anal heater. But one thing he says is that the immune system is given a huge boost. And he said that that's because a lot of the points that would normally be needled for the immune system are actually in the anus. And, of course, nobody's going to allow anybody to put any needles there. But if you do the anal heater, which is just, you know, 20, 40 minutes of this treatment where it's a small probe in your anus, that your immune system just gets a big boost. And I had one of those little apical abscesses that you talk about in your book. And I went ahead, and I didn't want to have oral surgery just because I just didn't have the time. You know how we are as surgeons. We just don't have time to take care of ourselves sometimes.
Right.
So I used the anal heater, and it actually went away. The whole infection went away with the use of the anal heater. So, you know, if your patients are having some immune challenges, and you think that, you know, some, like with fibromyalgia or other diseases that affect the immune system, you can have them use the anal heater rather than actually having to have the surgery or anything. Or you at least can give it a try. It may not work, but I think it works way better than antibiotics.
Interesting.
In my experience, yeah. I didn't even use antibiotics. I just used the anal heater, and I had a little bit of a pain, where the abscess was, and it went away completely with use of just that. So that was good.
One of the interesting things about these chronic inflammatory diseases, and what I treat patients with implants, but before I can put them in, I have to get rid of the disease in the gums, otherwise I'll lose my implants.
Right.
And I have the full variety of the chronic inflammatory diseases that patients come into my office. So inadvertently, I'm treating them for those diseases, because what I do first is I get rid of the bacteria around their gums and get their gums healthy, and then I get them on this daily regimen of hygiene, which eliminates the disease around their teeth. And believe it or not, almost without exception, these chronic inflammatory diseases get better. But the thing is, once these spirochetes get into the body and get embedded into the cells or wherever they go and get cystic or in their cell wall deficient forms, there's nothing that I know of that science can do to get rid of that. So there's no way to cure it, as far as I know. So the prevention is the key, and that's why I think every dentist needs a microscope, and they need to check the bacteria, a plaque sample from every single patient, every time they see the patient, because you can catch these at any time. You can catch them from people that you're intimate with, or you can get it from me. They're in the environment, so it needs to be monitored on a regular basis. And if the dentist would just do that and then just run betadine around the teeth and kill it, I mean, it would be so simple to eradicate these bugs. And I think another point I need to make, and the reason that we're seeing this huge increase in chronic inflammatory diseases, in my opinion, is because we're in an area in the last 100 years, and it's crescendoed over the last 20 or 30 of travel, and of people intermingling between each other. And spirochetes in one population, in a small isolated population, or the people in that population are pretty much immune to their own bacteria. But when they take that bacteria and take it somewhere else where patients aren't immune to that, that seems to be what the problem is. If you take syphilis, that was a problem because, well, it originated, I think, in Asia, and it went across the land bridge to the Americas, and then Columbus took it back to Europe, but it had been away from there for so many years that it had changed form and caused a huge epidemic of syphilis in Europe. And Lyme disease started out in Europe in the turn of the century, and then it ended up in the United States in the early 60s, and now that is the largest growing epidemic in the United States today, because we're not used to that particular spirochete. And so I think with oral spirochetes like trench mouth, in World War One. It probably came from some isolated population into Europe, and then it just went like wildfire through the industrial population of the world to create, like in Boston at the time, 1917, one out of three people in Boston had trench mouth. Now, we don't see as much of that today because our immune systems have had a chance to at least eliminate the acute part of the disease, but it's still chronic. And so if you just take those three spirochetal diseases and how they were transmitted and how we didn't have immunity originally, but we're building up immunity, you'd say maybe in 300 years we'll all be immune to each other's bacteria and we won't have these diseases anymore. But what do we do in the meanwhile? Well, we got to, you know, seek and destroy. In other words, the dentist takes a swab, looks at it in a microscope. If he sees spirochetes, irrigate with betadine, kill it, and see your patients on a regular basis. And pretty soon we'll eliminate these things. And if it's really hard because you got to do it with every person. But if you really wanted to, we could eliminate these diseases.
Well, I think, too, we need to, you know, consider that the bug bites. I was talking with Brian Rosner with his book, The Top 10 Lines Treatment. And
right.
We both agreed that probably some of these spirochete diseases are being transmitted in other ways that we don't even know about.
Including
mosquitoes and other things. So I would caution our audience to, you know, to treat any bug bite or any problem that you know that might be leading to a chronic fatigue disease, to treat to understand that you want to avoid situations where you get a lot of bug bites. You want to avoid situations where you make contact with people who you don't know well. You don't eat undercooked meat, and you take some of these precautions that we've mentioned today. You know, the people can buy betadine at the drugstore,
right.
And you know, and can you know, make diluted solutions and irrigate their mouth.
I have a paper that I have in my office, which I don't have my name on it, but it's called the Toolkit for sexually active single people.
Really interesting.
It's because if you're single and you want to meet people, you're going to get, you know, online, and you're going to meet people, and you're probably going to hit them, you know. It's
really
hard to avoid.
And we don't have barriers for that yet.
I was single for 5 years, about 5 years ago, so, and that's when I devised this toolkit for single people idea. But at any rate, I mean, the most diseases, sexual transmitted diseases, in my opinion, are passed orally, because you need an open access to the bloodstream to get them.
Right.
And where is that?
Exactly.
And the gingival disease, gingival sulcus. And I've even come to the conclusion that today probably syphilis is transmitted more orally than it is vaginally or sexually. Because I don't think the treponema pallidum can be, I don't think it can drill through epithelium. I really don't. I don't think it's a no more than an oral spirochete. You need a break in the skin for that to happen. Well, that break in the skin probably is created there orally, and the spirochete probably got to that lesion through the mouth and not you know, vaginally. So there's syphilis for you, and Lyme disease, we know that can be transmitted orally, and so can periodontal disease. So what I recommend is taking that hip cleanse, put it on your toothbrush, brush your teeth really well with it before you go on a date, and then when you get home from a date, do the same thing.
Do the same thing,
That way you're completely killing
it. So no oral condoms yet, huh?
No. Hippocleanse or tea tree oil or oil of oregano and or just plain soap. I mean, if you can just get a bar of soap and just really scrub your mouth out with soap. The thing with chlorhexidine is that it has about a 4 or 5 hour residual. So for single people, if they're going on a date and they think they might
that'd
have
be helpful,
contact, then brush your teeth and get chlorhexidine will get into tissue and have a 3-4 hour residual. And then when you get home, do the same thing and have your partner do the same thing. And I would say that most in my opinion, again, and I'm just a dentist, sexually transmitted diseases are transmitted orally, in my opinion.
When you think you're probably right.
Think about it, it's really true. So you can prevent all these things so easily.
Now, let me ask you this question. When you put the Hibiclens on your toothpaste, are you putting it within the toothpaste itself?
No, just on the toothbrush.
On the toothbrush?
Like 2 or 3 drops on your toothbrush.
Okay, so you're not diluting it at all. You're just putting it right there. Yeah. Because I was putting tea tree oil in my toothpaste and mixing it up and then doing that, just because the toothpaste seems to get into things that the tea tree oil may not get into.
Right.
I mean, it is a carrier. So I wanted to ask you if you'd considered working with a laboratory to detect these spirochetes with some other method, because I'm going to tell you, the dentists are going to be resistant to buying microscopes.
Oh, I know that. Believe me, I know
that. So why couldn't you come up with a lab test I'm sorry?
Dr. Neighbors has been working on that. He has a test that you can do, but the thing that is, right now, there's only one spirochete that tests for, which is...
Oh, no, that won't do.
There's 60 spirochetes that reside in the mouth. Lyme disease is probably 50 Lyme disease variations.
Exactly.
And so we had a major meeting where we all got together and lectured on this subject, and I talked to Dr. Neighbors. I said that I think that we're going to go down this DNA testing route, but you've got to get all the spirochetes, at least the vast majority, because I used to send samples out to the microbiology testing service at USC, Dr. Swatz.
Mm-hmm.
And they test the DNA test, but it's only for one or two. And I've had sent tests out that came back negative when I knew darn well I had spirochetes, so they saw them on my microscope. So in the interim, between now and the time we get tests where we have enough, we're testing for enough of the spirochetes. And I think you need to add the syphilis spirochete and the Lyme disease spirochetes in these oral tests as well, because
I'm convinced
that these spirochetes can all live and incubate in the gingival sulcus, because we're better. They're protected from the immune system there, and they can proliferate and create the environment that they need to cause a bacteremia, and then they get into the body. So we need to be able to do like a saliva test, but have enough of the DNA test so that includes the vast majority of the spirochetes that we know can live there. And when we get there, then we won't need the microscope. But in the interim, we do need the microscope.
Right.
We're trying to figure out a way to make a cheaper microscope.
Right, that's true. So you think that right now between 50 and 80% of Americans have periodontal disease, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and I guess it just depends
on what... They have chronic inflammatory diseases. Is that a coincidence?
Right.
I mean, it's like the biggest daw in history.
Would you like to give some of your contact information now? Do you have a website or any other information you'd like to give out?
Well, you can Google my name, and that's probably the easiest way to get to my stuff, just William D. Nordquist. But my publisher is Lyme Book. So it's www.linebook.com/Nordquist, and that's my blog.
I was interviewing Brian on his book, and then I was doing the next few weeks' interviews, and when I came to your name, he said, I published that book. That was really funny.
It was very coincidental, because I was going to self-publish it, because I didn't know how to publish a book. I'd never done one before. And I was studying Lyme disease when I called him, and I was going on vacation, so I needed a couple of his books overnighted to me.
Right.
And that's how I got talking with him.
That's great.
Yeah. But this goes right along with Lyme disease. And fact is, to be honest with you, I think people are being treated for Lyme disease when they actually have oral spirochetosis. And I know that because I've got patients that come in with diagnosis of Lyme disease, and they have spirochetes in their gingival sulcus, like unbelievable. So, and I do know there's cross-contamination between Treponema denticola and the Borrelia burgdorferi. I think there's cross-reactivity between those two spirochetes. So they're positive they're being tested for Lyme when actually they have oral spirochetosis. So that's why I think when we do the DNA testing from the saliva, we need to have all of the Lyme spirochetes included in that saliva test.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, people could have both too, because once your immune system goes down, like, we often see patients with their breast implants infected. We get them over that. We treat them with antifungals, and then lo and behold, they still have their joint pain. They still have, their night sweats. And so I go ahead and run the Lyme's test, and there they have the Lyme's disease as well. So my thinking is that the
Lyme and not oral spirochetosis.
Well, I don't. I mean, I just know their Western blot is positive, and that when I treat them for Lyme's disease, their joint pain goes away. But I don't know the. I don't test their saliva with a microscope, which is what I would have to do to rule that out.
Right, and the thing it is, I've never found a person with a chronic inflammatory disease that didn't have oral spirochetosis as well.
Right.
With oral spirochetosis, if you don't treat that, there's your reservoir for reinfection.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, and I'm not sure how many years it's going to take, but it'll be below a standard of care not to do a laparoscopic in the mouth to find out what they have before you do any surgery anywhere in the body.
Yeah, especially when you're putting an implant in.
Pardon me?
Especially when you're putting an implant in, like you and I do.
Right.
Because implants, we know very well, implants, orthopedic implants, heart valves, dental implants, and breast implants or other, penile implants, it doesn't really matter. When you implant things in the body, you start to have problems if you've got an immune disorder within the body.
You've got to check the gingival sulcus before you put any implants in anywhere.
Because
80% of people have gingivitis, so there you are.
Yeah.
And if that's not controlled, don't put the implants in. I mean, that's why I manufacture orthopedic appliances that are, right now they're embedded in for the teeth, but I have a major patent for attaching anything to any bone. In other words, hips, knees, spine,
anything, yeah.
And based on the technology that my laboratory does for making what we call custom endosteal implants that actually attach to the bone in the mouth, and we hook teeth to them. We've done a lot of dog research on it in Japan, and we're growing bone where you can't believe where we can grow bone now these days. But the problem is this bacteria. And I actually have developed a bacteriostatic grafting material. It's pure fluoroapatite. And that, if that was used in association with the orthopedic appliances where they want to grow bone, they wouldn't have the infections around the implants. Because we've been using this in dentistry using it for 10 years. And now we're at the point now where I'm publishing this material. And probably every graft that we have in the future, given enough time, will include this fluoroapatite because it actually inhibits the bacteria that tries to get going or try to inhibit the biofilm formation. Because as soon as the pH is dropped, the fluoride is leached out and then inhibits the infection.
Yeah.
So we're moving along and preventing this stuff.
Yeah.
It's taking time.
Well, we're at the end of our hour now, Dr. Norquist. We've been interviewing Dr. Norquist on the stealth killer. Is oral spirochetosis the missing link in dental and heart disease labyrinth? Next week we have Dr. Deborah Smith, her book Healthcare Solved, Real Answers, No Politics. And on the 9th, Linda Howe, How to Read the Akashic Records, Assessing the Archive of the Soul and Its Journey. And then Dr. Daniel Benor, Personal Spirituality, Science, Spirits, and the Eternal Soul on the 16th. Noetic Science will be meeting in January on Thursday, January 21st at 7:15 p.m. at the Georgetown Square Dunwoody office. Victor Clark will be speaking about handwriting analysis, its history and philosophy of science. And thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Norquist. We really enjoyed it, and good luck with your prevention of problems around implants, especially biofilms. And if you get anything that works for breast implants, give me a call.
I know, that's going to be a tough one.
We don't have bone usually around this. But anyway,
thank you
very much. We'll see y'all next week.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plasticos do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plasticos to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plasticos made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plasticos surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plasticos?
Plasticos is in Dunwoody. Plasticos is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plasticos number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute, you look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plasticos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone, skin, and contour the body. Endermology by Plasticos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plasticos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plasticos at 770-457-4677. Plasticos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.